Welcome to the deep dive. Our mission today is, well, it's pretty intense. We're diving into just one specific window, October 10th to the 12th, 2025. Just 72 hours, but it felt like everything happened at once. Major domestic conflicts, global tensions, they all just collided. Think about it. Day 10 of a government shutdown, you've got mass firings happening for political reasons, a really fragile Middle East ceasefire deal that's hanging by a thread, depending on just, what, 20 hostages. Then the stock market's tanking because of new tariffs, and there's this huge political fight over the justice system, all at the same time. So our goal for you is to kind of synthesize all these key developments, U.S. politics, international stuff, the economy, even some really personal stories. We want you to walk away informed, but not, you know, completely overwhelmed.
Right. And the source material we're looking at, mostly ABC News broadcast, Democracy Now! Reports. It shows just how dense and politically charged everything was. It wasn't like one thing happened and the next. It was everything accelerating at once, multiple crises flaring up simultaneously. It's a real challenge to unpack, clearly.
It absolutely is. So let's jump right in. Domestically first. The government shutdown, that was hitting federal workers really hard by this point, wasn't it?
Oh, definitely. We were into the second week and it had moved beyond just, you know, services stopping. The administration started taking punitive action.
Punitive how?
Well, President Trump had basically threatened this. He saw the shutdown not just as leverage, but as a chance to restructure things. So the layoffs started. They called them RIFs, reductions in force, confirmed at Education, Health and Human Services, Treasury.
RIFs. Okay. Do we know how many people?
The initial estimates were already over 4,000.
Yeah.
And everyone expected that number to climb.
Now, the official line was, you know, we have to cut costs. Congress isn't acting. But looking at the sources, especially what the president himself was saying, how much of this was really budget cuts versus, well, political payback?
Yeah, the budget cut claim looks pretty thin, honestly. The reports we have, quote, the president directly saying he was using this as an opportunity to, quote, cut more agencies. And crucially, he added, he'd only target, his words, Democratic programs, saying these were largely people that the Democrats want. That really suggests it's about political leverage, not, you know, fiscal prudence.
And the immediate impact on people, pretty brutal.
Absolutely. Lots of federal workers got only partial paychecks. But the really sharp edge was the military. 2 million service members were literally about to miss their paychecks completely that week.
2 million. That's huge.
It is. And there was this incredibly raw moment caught on TV. A military spouse confronted House Speaker Mike Johnson live. She was pleading with him, you know, pass the funding, not abstractly. She was talking about needing to pay medical bills for her kids, who she called medically fragile. She said the missed pay was putting her family's life at risk.
Wow, that really brings it home. It's not just numbers, it's families in crisis because of a political strategy.
Exactly. It shows how weaponizing a shutdown hits real people hard.
And what makes this even more jarring, I think, is that while this domestic pay crisis was unfolding, the administration was simultaneously making these huge financial moves overseas.
That's right. While U.S. troops and federal employees were facing, you know, potential insolvency, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent was finalizing a massive deal for Argentina. It was a $20 billion financial lifeline. Technically, a currency swap, U.S. dollars for Argentine pesos, basically, to prop up President Javier Milei's government, Milei being a known ally of President Trump.
So let's be clear on the analysis here. The administration chose to spend $20 billion supporting a foreign ally while its own military members weren't sure they'd get paid.
That seems to be the takeaway, yeah. It points to a real focus on the global stage, on political alliances, maybe over the immediate domestic consequences.
That calculus is revealing.
It really is. And it kind of sets the stage for the other big domestic storm that was brewing that week, the indictment of New York Attorney General Letitia James.
Okay, let's get into that. The charges themselves, two mortgage-related counts. Something about claiming a house in Virginia as a secondary residence to save about $19,000.
Yeah, on the surface, maybe it doesn't sound like a massive federal case, especially for such a high-profile target.
But the context is everything here, isn't it?
Absolutely critical. The sources we looked at confirmed that career prosecutors had already reviewed this exact same case earlier, and they rejected it. They didn't find enough evidence of fraud to actually bring charges.
So why did it suddenly come back?
Well, the sitting U.S. attorney, the one whose office rejected the case, was replaced. The new appointee, Lindsay Halligan, was handpicked by the administration. And her background, an insurance lawyer, zero prior experience as a prosecutor. But she apparently pledged to get things moving on certain politically sensitive cases.
So the real story isn't the $19,000 mortgage issue, it's the process. Bypassing the normal system, installing someone without experience specifically to resurrect a politically charged case against an opponent.
Precisely. It's the mechanics of how it happened that screams political retribution. James herself said as much in her response. She called it, quote, nothing more than a continuation of the president's desperate weaponization of our justice system.
Okay. Wow. So that's the domestic front. Shutdown, firings, military pay crisis, this highly political indictment. Now let's pivot. Theme two. The global stage, the Middle East ceasefire. It was incredibly tense too, right? Entering a really critical 72-hour window.
Extremely fragile, yeah. All eyes were on the planned release of the hostages still held by Hamas. There was hope, definitely cautious hope, but the numbers were grim. Officials thought maybe 20 hostages were still alive and might be released during that window.
Only 20.
Yeah. And tragically, it was also confirmed that 28 others were already deceased. Recovering their remains was also part of this complex agreement.
And this wasn't just Hamas releasing people. There was a huge exchange involved, right? Israel releasing prisoners.
A massive exchange. The release of those remaining, say, 20 hostages was directly tied to Israel, freeing over 1,000 Palestinian prisoners. And among those 1,000 were 250 people serving life sentences. So a really significant concession.
You could feel the weight of time, too. You mentioned the sources highlighted Hostage Square in Tel Aviv.
Yeah, there was this clock there just ticking away. It read something like 736 days, 14 hours, 42 minutes of captivity. Just a constant visible reminder of how long this had dragged on.
So the deal is happening. The exchange is planned. What role was the U.S. playing on the ground to make sure this fragile ceasefire actually held?
Well, this was new. For the first time in this phase, U.S. military personnel got involved directly.
Yeah.
About 200 U.S. troops started arriving in Israel. Their job, monitor the ceasefire, keep things calm.
Just monitoring, or was there a bigger plan?
There was definitely a bigger plan outlined. This hostage exchange was just the start, really. The sources talk about a phase two. That phase involved Hamas disarming, setting up some kind of non-political Palestinian governance committee, and even the possibility of movement towards a Palestinian state. President Trump himself planned to chair that whole process.
A very ambitious phase, too. But meanwhile, on the ground in Gaza, the immediate situation was dire.
Utterly dire. While diplomats negotiated, tens of thousands of Palestinians were trying to return to homes that were just bombed-out ruins. So the immediate focus had to be humanitarian aid. The plan was to get 600 aid trucks in per day, coordinated by the UN and other groups. They needed to rapidly scale up food distribution to over 2 million people to try and stave off famine.
So just as the world is maybe taking this tiny, cautious breath about the ceasefire, boom, the economy gets slammed, stock market tanks. What happened there?
Yeah, almost simultaneously, the Dow Jones just plummeted. Dropped nearly 900 points. Yeah. The U.S.-China trade war flared up again massively. Ah. President Trump announced a new, really drastic tariff, 100% on all Chinese imports. And this is on top of the 30% tariffs that were already in place. It was a huge escalation.
A 100% tariff. That's basically shutting down trade. What triggered such an extreme move?
Retaliation. Pure and simple. China had just announced new restrictions of its own. They limited access to rare earth minerals, and those minerals are absolutely essential for manufacturing tons of modern tech. Smartphones, electric car batteries, lots of components. So China restricts those.
And the U.S. responds with a 100% tariff across the board.
Exactly. The market saw that and thought, okay, this isn't just posturing anymore. This is a serious, potentially long-term economic conflict, and it's going to mess up global supply chains badly, hence the massive sell-off.
Okay, so we've got the domestic turmoil, the fragile ceasefire, and now a full-blown trade war shock. Let's move to theme three. This covers some other key domestic things happening, weather, legal challenges, and a really interesting personal story. First, the weather.
Yeah, while all this was going on, a huge storm system, a nor'easter, was crawling up the East Coast.
Yeah.
A major threat. It was slow-moving, which often means more prolonged rain and wind. States of emergency were declared in New York, New Jersey.
What were the main impacts expected?
Heavy rain, significant coastal flooding was a big worry, and wind gusts up to 60 miles per hour. That obviously hammered air travel. Over 5,000 flights were delayed just in the Northeast airports because of the storm.
Okay, so a major weather event on top of everything else. Now, back to the legal system for a moment. We talked about the Letitia James indictment, but there was another interesting court development, this one in the Midwest.
Right. In Chicago, a federal judge actually stepped in to block President Trump's plan to deploy hundreds of National Guard troops to Illinois.
Why? What was the reasoning?
The judge basically said the administration's justification, based on Department of Homeland Security assessment, was, quote, unreliable.
Mm.
And significantly, the judge expressed concern that putting troops on the ground would just, quote, add fuel to the fire, meaning it would worsen tensions already high because of some provocative icy enforcement actions happening in Illinois at the time.
So another instance of the judiciary pushing back, acting as a check on executive actions perceived as politically motivated or inflammatory.
Exactly. It reinforces that dynamic of tension between the branches of government.
Now, amidst all this political and economic chaos, there was this one story that seemed to cut through in a different way, a very personal one. Foreign correspondent James Longman and his book, The Inherited Mind.
Yeah, it got quite a bit of attention that week. Longman had gone on this really difficult journey to understand his father's death, which was a suicide linked to schizophrenia. And his search led him deep into the science of, you know, genetics, mental health, predisposition.
What was the key insight he shared from that?
He developed this really powerful analogy about hardware versus software when it comes to genetics and mental health. The hardware, he said, is maybe only 2% of our genetic code. That's the part that might give you an unchangeable predisposition for something, like schizophrenia in his father's case. You can't change the hardware.
Okay, so if the hardware is fixed, what about the software?
That's the other 98%. And that, he argued, can be changed or managed. The software is your environment, your support systems, therapy, medication, lifestyle choices, all the things that interact with that predisposition.
So the message isn't one of genetic destiny, then?
Not at all. It's the opposite, really. His journey, his research, it all pointed to the power of that 98%. While you can't erase a genetic risk, you can profoundly influence how it plays out.
So for listeners maybe grappling with their own family histories or mental health challenges, what was the ultimate takeaway from his deeply personal investigation?
The absolute vital importance of connection and support. He summed it up very simply. You can't go through life on your own. Finding community, asking for help, building those support systems, that's how you manage the software. It felt like a really necessary human message in a week full of conflict.
That is powerful. And finally, just touching on culture, there were tributes that week for two very different but beloved figures who passed away.
That's right. Sister Jean, the chaplain from Loyola University Chicago, she became this huge March Madness icon, didn't she? Passed away at 106. Famous for her prayers and her great sense of humor. Like that line about praying for the other team, just perhaps not as hard, though. A real character.
A legend. And also Diane Keaton.
Yes, the Oscar-winning actress.
Yeah.
Passed at 79. Obviously known for huge films like Annie Hall, The Godfather.
Mm-hmm.
But interestingly, in her memoir, she had revealed her personal favorite film she was in was actually Something's Gotta Give, that romantic comedy with Jack Nicholson.
A little moment of quiet reflection on culture amidst all the noise.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So if we try to synthesize this whole intense week, October 10th to 12th.
Yeah.
What does it tell us? I think it just shows this constant pressure cooker we live in now. You've got massive global crises like the ceasefire rubbing right up against fierce domestic political battles like the shutdown and the indictment. And then layered on top are these deeply personal struggles and stories like James Longman's. It's all happening at once. And so much of it feels driven or shaped by political agendas.
Right. And I think the core idea for you, the listener, is seeing how interconnected it all is, whether it's the stock market falling because of tariffs that seem politically motivated or thousands losing their jobs in a shutdown used as political leverage. The information hitting you and often the real world consequences are increasingly tied to political will or political threats. It just demands that we all stay informed and, frankly, critical. Hopefully this deep dive helped with that.
And it leaves us with a pretty significant question to mull over, doesn't it? We saw the justice system used in a way that seems overtly political with the Letitia James case. We saw the global economy hit by tariffs that also seem politically driven. So the question for you is, how do you even begin to distinguish between government actions taken for legitimate national policy reasons versus those taken purely for political leverage or retribution? And maybe more importantly, for the millions affected by the shutdown, by the tariffs, by the instability, does that distinction even matter in the end?
That is definitely something to think about. A heavy note to end on, but an important one. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into one incredibly packed week. We'll catch you next time.